Forest, may I help you?
Hi, Brad. This is Rachel. How are you?
Well, Rachel, I'm putting you on my voice here.
Okay, that's fine.
All right.
I have got Kayla here and Emerson, and we got you on speakerphone as well. And we're recording you, just so you know.
Okay, no problem.
So how did you become involved in the PA profession, and what experiences were influential in getting you involved?
I'm kind of, and I guess that's part of the reason why you wanted to talk to me, because I'm one of the old guys. And I actually was a medic, combat medic, in the U.S. Army, and I came in at the ending, basically, of Vietnam. I came in the U.S. Army in 1973, and I was trained as a Special Forces aideman, so I was on an A-team, and I traveled quite a bit of the world and did a lot of third world healthcare. And through that, in the early vestiges of the profession, a lot of the Special Forces medics that had gotten off a team went on to be PAs.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to see this phenomena of PAs, although I personally chose to get out in 1977, and I went initially to complete my undergraduate. I went to Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University, which is better known as Virginia Tech, and thought I was going to be pre-veterinarian. And actually, I ended up attending physical therapy school at the Medical College of Virginia, but just felt like that really wasn't going to be it. So I started pursuing then at that point in time the opportunity for physician assistant.
Okay. Oh, well, you answered question number two as well. let's see. What were major barriers that you had to overcome to become a physician assistant?
Well, first of all, in 1980, there weren't as many PA programs.
Right.
So, you know, you geographically, I relocated from Richmond, Virginia, all the way to San Antonio, Texas, to attend school. And I attended a military program, the U.S. Air Force program, so you already had to have been at a certain rank, and application was really rigorous.
Mm-hmm.
Not to suggest it isn't today, but it was, you know, at the time there were a lot of people applying for very few slots.
Right.
And then I think just the whole uncertainty of the profession at that point in time, there were no states with prescriptive authority.
Right.
It was just kind of, you're kind of going out on faith to say this is going to be pretty cool, but we didn't really know. I mean, there was a lot of good track record in the military, but it was really kind of anyone's guess as to where the profession was really moving and if it was going to be a real good outcome or not.
Okay. Now, the program today for getting it through the military anyways, it's still pretty rigorous, isn't it? Or
it is.
The application, I thought, process was pretty tough.
It is. They've consolidated, though. Now they have one uniform services, which is all the programs. I actually, ironically, I was Army, but I attended the Air Force PA program. And they would take about 4 a year to enter the PA program in the Air Force. They take about 4 Army a year.
Yeah.
And so the reason why I attended the Air Force program is it was one of the only bachelor's programs, believe it or not, in the United States. At the time, most of them were certificates, and I wanted to do
okay.
a bachelor's program.
Right. Okay. So once you got finished with school, did you do Army time after that or Air Force time after that? Or did you go straight into clinical practice?
Yeah, I had a 6-year commitment to the Army Guard after completing. So it wasn't a full-time position. It was just a reserve position that
right.
I held 6 years back.
Okay. So after you finished that, then did you go into clinical practice, like civilian?
Well, for 2 years to get my training, and I completed my clinical year at Brooke Army Medical Center at San Antonio.
Uh-huh.
And so when I completed it, then I started looking for a job, and there weren't a lot of jobs. This is kind of the humbling part. So while I was waiting to get a lot of job interviews and what have you, I had to work, so I got a job at JCPenney's. I was working in the men's department.
Uh-huh.
And then I finally got a couple telephone calls. And my first job, actually, was with the Colorado State Penitentiary. I actually worked for the penitentiary system, and it was interesting because Colorado had hired nothing but former military PAs out of the out of Fort Carson there.
Uh-huh.
And they were looking for another PA, and I guess by virtue of my credentials, I sufficed for them to take this position. So I did so, and that allowed me to kind of get my experience such that then I could start applying for some primary care positions and what have you.
Okay. So at what point did you decide that you were going to transition from clinical to educator?
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. So I finished my degree with the University of Oklahoma and practiced for, a good 14, 15 years, and I was in a cardiology group up in Maine, and I was with a really great cardiology group, by the way, and had done a lot, learned a lot. And during that time, I also became an ACLS instructor and did a lot of teaching on the side, and I did some guest lecturing for different things, for different topics, for nursing service and what have you. And everybody would always say, oh, you know, you're really good at teaching. And I was like, yeah, maybe. And I was very interested in returning to get my graduate degree, and at that time, Alderson Broaddus was the first PA program that actually offered a master's degree.
Right.
And I pursued that. It was a master's in science with our emphasis in rural primary care. So I attended that and got my graduate degree. Well, in order to do that, you had to go to school in West Virginia, and UK, University of Kentucky, happened to have a faculty position open then, so I applied for it and was accepted, and that was my transition. So I started my academic career in 1994.
Okay. Well, that is interesting.
it kind of came up a little faster than I anticipated.
Right?
Yeah, it was kind of one of those oops, you know, I got into it faster than I really had expected to. So,
right.
You know, it just seemed like it kind of was the right time, the right place.
So you went. Yes. So you.
I was in a cardiology group up in Maine, and I had been looking at the Alderson Broaddus program, which of course is in Philippi, West Virginia, and it would have been probably just logistically impossible to continue to practice cardiology. First of all, to get off that much time to go to graduate school was going to be difficult.
Okay.
So University of Kentucky happened to be looking for a new faculty member, and part of my contract with them is they would give me the 2 years to complete my master's degree with AB.
Gotcha.
while still serving as, and I wasn't brought in as a professor, I was brought in as a clinical instructor initially.
Okay. So you have opened some programs outside of Kentucky. Do you plan to open any more programs in the future?
Yeah, I saw that on the question. I kind of had to laugh because I'm like, not unless I want to, potentially do harm to myself. I was like, actually, you'll find it's interesting. I just had your program director. I'm one of the national faculty for the program director's workshop.
Uh-huh.
So your program director was at the program director's workshop this past weekend. So I actually was one of her teachers this weekend.
Well, I hope she wasn't a bad student.
No, she's a great student, and I encouraged her to seek me out, and that we should meet periodically just to work together as programs, and I would be happy to try to help her if I could. But So to go back to your original question, you know, never say never.
Right.
You know, I doubt that I'm going to go look for a new program, particularly now that there's 187 programs. You know, I'm one of those people, I'm starting to get to the point I'm thinking we're getting a little bit too many programs, and I'm a little concerned about where we're going with that. So, you know, if I went out there and started another program at this point in time, I would feel like I was maybe not walking my talk, so to speak, and that wouldn't be true to what I think we need to be thinking about right now.
So what do you think that we need to be thinking about?
Well, I think we really, you know, I want to really continue to stress quality of education,
mm-hmm.
not quantity.
Oh, and, okay, gotcha.
Yeah, and it's not to say, and please, let me be clear, you're not going to find your a bigger advocate and proponent of our profession. I really, really want to see our success.
Right.
And I do believe we want to continue to make sure that we're getting sufficient numbers out there to meet the primary care needs of the United States and beyond. And so, you know, I don't want to say, well, I don't know what the magic number is. I don't know if there is. I guess the more important question or concern of mine is we want to maintain quality. That's my mantra. And so I just get a little bit concerned when you start getting so many programs, particularly when you get so many overlap programs in some areas, that you might give up some of that quality.
Right. Right. No, that's completely understandable. So Kentucky only having two programs now, is that a concern at all for you, or do you think that that's okay?
You mean as far as not having very many programs?
Yeah, just not, well, and being having PAs in general in the state.
Well, you know, as you all know, we just recently, you know, had some good legislative initiatives and some passes that are really good for PAs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all fine and dandy, but we still need to have a culture change in our state. And so I think, you know, there's still a lot of work yet to be done. And to be honest, I know I've watched a considerable number of our class leave the state of Kentucky just because the opportunities weren't there.
Right, right.
And until we really, the state responds to that, it really starts to enhance the recruitment of physician assistants. You know, I don't know if having a third and fourth and a fifth program are going to be
any helpful.
Not to the state of Kentucky, particularly.
Right. So where do you see the career going in the future?
As far as the University of Kentucky?
In general.
In general?
Mm-hmm.
The PA education or the PA profession?
The profession.
Oh, okay, the profession. Well, first of all, I guess I see the future of medicine to be a lot of APPs, a lot of advanced practice providers, being the frontline providers of care, and that
right.
being both PAs and nurse practitioners.
Right.
You know, whether we like it or not, they're part of that advanced practice.
Oh, yeah.
And we'd be crazy not to acknowledge that.
Right.
Now, I think it's important for us to continue to emphasize team-based care, because that's really our mm-hmm. mantra as PAs, whereas it appears that nurse practitioners are really going to press hard with reference to the independent practice, because I think they feel that will allow them to enhance their primary care population, what have you, and that may in fact be the case. So I think it's really important for us to continue our team-based care. I do think we'll see a future that will bring, I don't know if we'll go to an entry-level doctorate, but I do believe we'll see a lot of clinical doctorates
mm-hmm.
out of PA education that will start to prop up. I think we'll see a lot of them.
Right.
I think that's just poised to happen. I think the switch has been turned on by the U.S. Army with reference to their PhD program in emergency medicine.
Right.
And I think we'll see that switch get turned on to a very high scale here in the next year or two. I do think I would like to see that we would be able to have more primary care focused programs. I don't know if that will improve, though, where unless med schools and the family practice and primary care residency slots go up and people have returned to those rural underserved areas, you know, unless you got doctors there, you're not necessarily going to get PAs there, obviously.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, you kind of get one with the other. It's not either or.
Right.
So I think we have a lot of work to do on that end. But I think the future is bright for PAs, particularly in the subspecialties.
Right.
You know, that's where doctors really like us. That's where we do our best work, is in the hospitals.
Right.
In the operating room, in different subspecialty type areas. I'd like to sing the primary care song, but I've got to be honest and say, you know, where our bread has been buttered the last decade has really been with the subspecialties.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So what in Kentucky, how do you see the future there for PAs?
We've had an uphill battle because we already have shortages of docs in the rural underserved areas, and we need to really improve our access to care in those areas. So, you know, I think that's going to be extremely important. And I think we need to continue to enhance our relationship with physicians, that being the AMA, and having you know, that face-to-face conversation on a regular basis. It really breaks down some of those barriers and really enhances the quality outcomes of fee-based care.
Right. Okay, this is a... just kind of a pop-up question here. How do you feel about the, like, nurse practitioners, how they can write for narcotics? Do you have any opinion on PAs as far as being able to write for narcotics and stuff?
Well, we're only one of two states that doesn't allow for scheduled drugs to be written by PAs. So I think if you look at the sheer numbers, we have been successful in a lot of states, a lot of areas being able to write controlled substance. And I think to suggest that we shouldn't be able to in Kentucky is wrong. Now, with that said, I know when I first got here, that was kind of the big push by Kappa. And I don't know if it was me or who it was, but quite frankly, I said that shouldn't be your focus. Our biggest focus was the 18-month and then the co-signature, because if you had to co-sign everything, that's the biggest hindrance to hiring anybody to roll.
Right.
Okay. So although I think narcotics, let's not just say narcotics, there's a lot of other scheduled drugs.
Right.
There's antipsychotic meds, there's anesthetics, what have you. Even some of the antiarrhythmics are scheduled drugs. So it does enhance your capabilities to write for other medications. Quite frankly, not having the ability to write for narcotics doesn't really bother me. So
right,
much.
Right.
But nonetheless, it does affect some people, and I think any time that you limit the ability of providers who do have knowledge with reference to pharmacotherapy, I think you really take away a really dynamic part. So although I don't push it hard, I do think that it does limit some of our PAs out there in being able to offer more comprehensive care.
I was just wondering why you're not bothered by that. Is it because you're not practicing?
No. You mean by not having narcotics?
Yes.
No, not. That's not why. I do believe I'm not bothered by the fact that we don't have the opportunity to write scheduled drugs. So I guess, and I am bothered for other people who might be in practices that do really necessitate that. So let me be clear. I guess I was making a personal statement. To be honest, let's face it. When you work primary care and you have a lot of folks that are seeking narcotics for not the right reasons, it can be. It's difficult. It can really, you almost feel like you get in a debate with the patient.
Right.
Offering the best level of care. So, sometimes not having to get engaged in those debates is a good thing. You know, it's not a bad thing.
Right.
And so I support PAs having full scheduled authority to write for medications. And quite frankly, the individual practice is going to determine what's necessary or not. And so, you know, let the doctor legislate what they want the PA to write for or not write for that matter. Don't let the state tell us what
right.
to do.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, I could see being in a primary care practice saying, I'd like to set it up that when a patient comes in and they're seeking OxyContin, that quite frankly, they have a discussion with the doctor about that. I wouldn't have any problems with that at all.
Right.
And I'm not willing, and I'm certainly willing to stand up and say to the patient, you need to be, you know, responsible for your care, and I'm not going to endorse that. But, you know, some of those just, you know, there are occasions when I think the doctor does need to be involved when it comes mm-hmm. to something that appears to be drug-seeking. I guess that's
right. This is just a personal question of my own. I used to work in an ER, and since Kentucky added the Casper system,
yeah.
We had like a huge, you know, drop in the amount of people that came in. Did you have any opinion about that?
No, you know, it was really interesting. A lot of people were very irritated by the Casper system, and I personally think it was a great innovation, and I think it was necessary in the state of Kentucky. So I agree with you. I think that has been a great measure that was instituted, and the colleagues that I have or who are in those positions are able to pull that Casper and say,
right.
Well, you know, Mr. Jones, I'm sorry, you know, it appears that you've
right.
had multiple prescriptions here of OxyContin, and it's just not in your best interest for me to refill this.
Right. Okay. Another one here. This is number 7 on the paper. You've had a lot of leadership roles. Is there one that you particularly have liked the most or had the most job satisfaction out of?
Boy, that's interesting. Well, probably right now, being on the Faculty Development Institute with the PAEA in terms of teaching other program directors is probably one of the most satisfying, actually. I've been on committees of finance, been on professional practice. I was the president of GAPA, the Georgia Association of PAs. I've been mm-hmm. the director of large in Kentucky. I've been on the House of Delegates. I always enjoy serving on the House of Delegates. I think that there are some timely discussions there that really need some people that are willing to be, who are willing to grapple with some tough policies and
right.
how we as a profession want to handle those. So I would say the House of Delegates, and then serving on the PAEA faculty for new program director workshop has been my most satisfying leadership roles.
Okay. And then lastly here, we wanted to ask you about the Affordable Care Act. How do you feel about that, and what is the role of the PA? Where's it going to go? Just anything, any opinion you have at all on that.
Okay.
And we're not going to judge you.
Well, I mean, you know, whether I won't get into philosophy, whether you believe it or not. I mean, I think ACA was a step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
We all know that we have runaway costs with reference to the gross, you know, national product of the percentage of how much we spend on healthcare and
right.
general outcomes when you compare us to other developed countries like the Netherlands and the United Kingdom and Japan. We fall well below them.
Right.
And so, you know, I think there was no doubt that we had to have some means of new healthcare regulations. And I think the direction that we're moving with emphasizing healthcare outcomes and preventive care.
Right.
There's a fee for service is definitely the direction we should be going in.
Right.
You know, but it's going to be like turning the Titanic.
Right.
This is not going to be this is going to take a long time to get implemented. And And it's also going to change, it's going to require a cultural change among our population. Our population has become very comfortable with going in and getting their procedures done and having somebody take care of all their ailments. And they have had to have little responsibility. And the future of medicine is really saying this is a partnership, and you're as involved with your health care as anybody else is.
Right.
And that's gonna be highly frustrating, because if they're paying only for outcomes, and let's say we get paid one lump sum for somebody's congestive heart failure, but I'm not there when that person is eating a salt-laden picnic on Sunday and comes into flash pulmonary edema, and it would suggest that my care of that patient was less than optimal.
Right.
And I have problems with that.
Right,
you know?
Right, so, I agree.
So I agree that ACA or something of that effect had to happen, and I think that was a good move. And I do believe it's going to, you know, obviously it's allowing everybody to have access to care, which I think is important too.
Right.
But we have some big paradigms that we have to shift also. And that includes patients who are responsible for their health, and also allowing teams. One of the things that's really interesting in the team dynamics and what we're trying to teach with interprofessional education is, you know, for 100 years, the doctors feel that they're always in charge. And there's going to be some cases when they're not in charge, and that's okay. And we got to get over some of that thinking, too.
Right.
That it's okay to acquiesce a team leader to possibly be a PA or an NP or even a nurse in certain circumstances.
Right.
And that's a shift for doctors and what doctors' thinking has been over a long time. So, you know, so all related to the ACA, we're moving in the right direction. It's a good thing. We just have a long time, and we have to be very patient on the implementation.
Right.
This and be realistic with the goals and outcomes. And I think we kind of had this almost over-the-top belief of how this was going to be implemented. And
right.
And we're, you know, we have a long ways to go.
Right. I think Kayla had one question for you. Did you?
Well, I actually have two, but I don't really know how to word this without... It might be confusing, but I feel like there's a lot of expectations in the PA profession, and I was wondering if you disagree with anything as far as... What do you feel... Does anything about you stand out in the PA profession as far as you don't agree with something or you want something different? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think I'm... Let me see if I can answer this. So, yeah, I'm taking a second to think here. Because you're recording me.
That's okay.
Turn off the recorder. No, I'm just kidding. If I can't stand behind my words, then they're not true.
You don't have to answer me either.
Yeah, you don't have to.
I just want to know something unique.
I haven't been particularly lining up, let me put it that way, as opposed to please. I haven't been particularly lining up with some of our executive strategies on behalf of the American Academy of Physician Assistants. I think I don't think we've done enough to get involved with politics on Capitol Hill. I don't think we push some of the agendas hard enough. I think we are often reactive as opposed to being proactive in some cases. And I think, you know, we just have to have strong lobbyists and a strong presence on Capitol Hill and on national issues and national debates. And
right.
I just haven't seen that from the national organization. I just feel, now that said, I know they struggle with getting significant numbers of PAs to become members and become involved, which is worrisome to me as well. You know, that's one thing I get concerned about our profession. I see a lot of PAs who graduate and never get involved with their state, never get involved with
right.
their, and they just kind of think, well, you know, I'll do what I like to do and I don't want to be bothered. Well, if you talk to any of our students, you will know that I say when you choose to become a physician assistant, it's not optional whether or not you want to be an advocate of your profession.
It is
absolutely paramount. And so there's complacency among our ranks. I'm not real always lining up with where our executive direction is on behalf of our national organization. And I think we can just do a heck of a better job.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I think that's all of the questions that we had for you. I know that you have something that you have to do soon. But if you have anything else that you want to tell us?
Yeah, I'm sitting there thinking a little bit. Well, let me just share this with you. When I started my career in 1982 as a graduate PA, I never, never expected in my wildest dream that this profession would be as great as it's become.
Right.
It's been bigger and better than I ever thought. And the opportunities that I personally have enjoyed, I would have never thought would have occurred. So I think it's been a great ride, as they say, and I'm excited to be a member and a part of this profession.
Right.
And I think its legitimacy, its professionalism, has just continued to escalate in a really outstanding manner. So I guess I'd just like to say that. The other thing I'd like to see is there's a guy who's done some work on different PhD and doctoral work. I just don't feel like we've done a good job of creating opportunities, particularly for educators, to get their advanced degrees. You usually have to get a PhD in, like, higher ed.
Right.
And although there's some relevance, I think we could do a much better job of helping to develop our young faculty.
Right.
We put a heck of a lot on them, and we don't really give them the tools to be successful.
Right.
And it's tough. It's really tough transitioning from the clinical to the academic world. People don't really understand what they're getting into, and most of the time they're very disenchanted, and then within the course of 2 years they quit.
Right.
So I really think we need to do a lot in that respect as well.
Right. Have y'all had a large turnover of, like, new employees at UK?
I'm going to knock on some wood here, and I've reasoned. No, we have not. And to me, the stability of a program, a PA program, is built on the stability of the faculty.
Right.
When you have high turnover of faculty, PA programs don't do well.
Right.
So you really have to have a stable faculty for this. You know, it's kind of almost like family dynamics. You know, when parents get divorced, kids don't do as well, typically, in academics and other things because they don't have that grounded basis for them. And I apologize for making an analogy with marriage, but to some degree, you know, this is a family. Any PA program is a faculty. And when you have high turnover, it's hard to keep continuity among the program.
Right.
And I just think that the students are the stakeholders who really suffer the most.
Right. Well, I pray that doesn't happen to our program.
I was really, I enjoyed being your director, and I also, by the way, when it comes to new programs, a lot of people call me up when someone was developing a new program, and they go, you know, aren't you really upset? And I was like, no. I was like, this is our profession, and I said, I want nothing but them to be an outstanding program, just as I want Sullivan to be an outstanding program, because it makes us as a profession stronger. And to suggest that I would be hateful or distrustful or not want to wish the best on my colleagues and other programs is absolutely incorrect, at least on my part it is.
Right.
I just think that's the wrong tack to take. I mean, we're all in this. We're a small enough profession that we really have to take care of our own. And
right.
If we don't, doing ourselves a disservice.
Right.
So there's my soapbox. and by the way, you mentioned me not clinically practicing right now. But believe me, every single week I want to, but the demands of being a program director are pretty heavy, and I don't like being out of practice right now. I really want to, and I'm seeking to get back to practicing here at least one day a week soon.
Right.
But golly, I tell you, there's a lot of demands.
Yeah, that's I don't know how you do that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so very much. We really, really appreciate it. And your story was super interesting. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, I appreciate it. I don't know if my story's that interesting, but and then you guys know about my military side. Of course, I was in the military. I stayed in the reserves for 40 years.
Oh wow!
And I just retired in April of this year.
So, Brad, can you leave us off with like a one sentence thing about how you feel about PAs or the profession? Something that you think about the profession?
Yeah, I think my one sentence, and I really haven't practiced this, but my one sentence would be, I believe that you are positioned to be in a great profession with a great future. But I would go back and emphasize that every PA has to be an advocate for their profession.
Yes.
Young, new, old, I don't care where you are, you must be an advocate for your profession, and because that's the only way you're going to ensure both having the greatest capabilities but also the greatest voice when it comes to the future of healthcare. And so I think you guys are in a, well, let me just put it this way. My daughter is applying to PA school as we speak.
Aww.
Yeah, and I really am hoping that I have my own child as a second generation PA. And I think that speaks highly because, you know, a lot of people don't recommend their children to go into the profession they're in, but
right.
I do.
Right.
And I would love to see my daughter in the profession. I would love to continue to watch her progress in what I consider is a great, great, great profession.
Well, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.